Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Well, my wonderful audience, I'm glad to have you out there because I got stuff to share with you about the dangerous adventures of my reform work. I have been the expert, I was the only expert in the whole case, of the Michelle Carter case, which is the, at the time, 17-year-old girl who allegedly told her boyfriend to get back in his truck and kill himself. The truck was filled with carbon monoxide as one of his many, many suicide attempts. And he allegedly came out of the truck and said, I'm scared, and or something like that. And she allegedly told him to go back in the truck. The result of this was her conviction on manslaughter. The judge, relenting somewhat when it came time later to sentence her, gave her effectively only 15 months when this very, very violent prosecution in the district attorney's office in Massachusetts wanted her to get 7 to 12 years, and she could have gotten 20. And then he stayed the 15 months, thank goodness, while this very controversial trial is being appealed. I then began a series of blogs about Michelle Carter because no one knows the story. No one knows what actually happened. And I'll try to explain that to you as the blogs go on. The first blog came out and had almost 30,000 viewers. The second one is way up, pretty high too. I think they're totaling around 45,000 now. I hope you will go to Bregan.com. On the left-hand side of my sort of recent accomplishments section at the top, there's a little red heading at the top. On the left-hand side, you'll see that you can go direct to the Michelle Carter blogs and archives. I'm developing a media and video archives pertaining to Michelle's trial in life. And take a look at it. You can also go to my frequent alerts, which is, I mean, God, we're getting thousands and thousands of people now looking at the frequent alerts that I'm putting out. Try to get them out at least once a week and keep people up on what's going on, including my blogs and including what is now happening. Well, the prosecution in Bristol District, Massachusetts, not real happy about somebody finally getting Michelle's story out because they have manipulated the media so that everybody thinks Michelle is a horrible human being because, they didn't say this, but they got this across by taking a limited number of texts that she made during a 10-day period in which she collaborated with him, urged him or encouraged him with his desire to go ahead and complete his suicide. He had many attempts, some very close to succeeding, at least one very close to succeeding. So the DA is going after me. The allegation is I'm using medical materials that were not allowed to be used by order of the judge. And that's not it at all. They don't want anybody, which I didn't do, which they don't want anybody presenting the real truth about this trial because they manipulated this trial, manipulated public opinion, in a most tragic and unfair way. So go and read my first two blogs about this. And I'll start blogging again after a hearing on Monday that I'm probably not going to, wasn't invited to in particular, told I could come. But there will be a hearing on Monday where the judge will be following up on what was a very moderate response to a very violent attack from the DA. He just wants to confirm that Dr. Bragan is not using these sequestered, barred, embargoed is the technical word, materials. But I want to read you something, and then I'll finish up with this and go to a very interesting guest who's going to give us a view on life that we rarely, rarely get on the show, worldwide view. The judge's statement about in response to the attack on me by the DA from Bristol, assistant DAs, and I'll be writing a lot about them in the future. You're going to be astonished to learn about the relationships between the DAs in Bristol and the family of the boy who committed suicide. And the DA wrote to the judge in handwriting. I don't know if she planned to send me this. She was sending me something else, and maybe this just slipped in because I didn't get this from the judge. And it's her handwritten cover letter for her allegations. And this is what it says. The Commonwealth, this is a quote, the Commonwealth's request, this court, order Peter Bragan to cease any publication, description of any information he received in the course of this case until further notice of the court. In other words, contrary to the court's instructions, which were that I could talk about anything I testified about in court and anything I had other information about, and I also have permission from Michelle Carter to talk about her records, medical records. I've written permission from her. So I can talk all about that. The only thing that's embargoed now is Conrad Roy, the boy who committed suicide, his records. But this is what the Commonwealth's asking for. They're actually asking for something that I don't know occurs in America, which is to stop me from publishing, future publishing. So let me read it to you again. The Commonwealth requests this court order Peter Bragan to cease any publication, description of any information he received in the course of this case until further notice of the court. I mean, any information I got in the course of this case, you know, I interviewed people. I read media. I got that information. And lots of other things that aren't embargoed and can't be embargoed because an awful lot of it's out in the world. But this is what I'm up against. And you know what this says? I think you're going to be surprised by what I say right now. What this proves is the host of this show is still having an impact on these folks. Because this is a trial about two youngsters whose lives were destroyed by bad psychiatric treatment and psychiatric drugs. That's the main story. Then there's the destruction of Michelle's life by overzealous prosecution and overzealous district attorney manipulation of the media. So we have the tragic death of the boy who is on psychiatric drugs, as I testified in court, and who, as I testified, had recent changes in his psychiatric drugs, his antidepressants, and Michelle Carter, whom, as I testified in court, had recent changes in her medication, her antidepressant. And between the two of them being so reacting to their medications and to their own issues and problems, and with the encouragement of Conrad, Michelle got to believe that the devil was literally, because Conrad told her, guiding what they were doing. And then Conrad eventually enlisted her in the emails to help him finally do away with his pain. And I'm going to write all about this. Two good blogs up already, more to come. And I don't need the records of Conrad Roy, because enough of his life came out in the trial and is out in the media to write about this. So that's where I am right now. Let me see if my guest is aboard. Stefan, I think you're there, aren't you?
Hello, yes.
Could you hear all that pretty clearly?
I could hear you very well, yeah.
Good. Well, Stefan X, E-C-K-S, pronounce your name for me so I'm sure I'm getting it right. Never talked to you before.
You got it perfectly right. It's Stefan X.
Good, Stefan X. Now, I'm interviewing him in part to fulfill my promise, but I'm glad I'm doing it, to James Davies, who edited The Sedated Society, a really good book. It's come out of a publisher, Palgrave Macmillan, that does a lot of good critical books on psychiatry and has a great chapter by me on tardive dyskinesia in The Sedated Society, and has a very interesting chapter by Stefan. And I want to just jump into talking about this. Stefan's background is really, really quite remarkable. He's director of Anthropology of Health, the Anthropology of Health and Illness program at Edinburgh. And he's also the lecturer in social anthropology. And I think some of the best information in the world is in the hands of anthropologists. So I'm really looking forward to this. And he's carried out ethnographic work that's right on the land there with the real folks on health and medicine in India. And that's where he's got a lot of his expertise, and in Southeast Asia and the pharmaceutical assault, I will call it. He says the trajectories of key drugs to production, distribution, prescription, and consumption in India and Nepal. And he's got books. One is Eating Drugs. It's a great title. Eating Drugs, Pharmaceutical Pluralism in India, and also Psychopharmaceuticals in India. Now, don't say I'm not interested in India. Don't quit at this point, because we've got the opportunity through looking at this to get a deeper and deeper understanding of how the giant octopus that I call now the pharmaceutical empire, when I was focused down just on psychiatry, I called it the psychopharmaceutical complex, but how the pharmaceutical empire is strangling the world. Stefan X, is that too strong a statement, a pharmaceutical octopus strangling the world?
It's a very interesting image, particularly when you turn towards India and you look at what's happening there on the ground. And I guess sort of if you were looking at an octopus, then it's not the octopus of the U.S. and European pharmaceutical companies, which play a major role in India and an increasing role, but definitely you'd also have to look at the Indian pharmaceutical companies who've been basically producing generic versions of all of the psychopharmaceuticals that have been first patented in the U.S. and in Europe. But they've been, you know, producing these drugs for a long time and in their own generic way, and there's hundreds or even thousands of versions of these drugs out there. But really, sort of the market in India for these drugs is basically controlled by Indian companies. So when you're looking at an octopus of pharmaceutical companies in India, it will look very different, and in many ways sort of, you know, it has a very different dynamic, I think, than what you can see in the United States or in Europe.
Well, tell us about that dynamic. I really want to hear what's going on over there.
Well, I mean, the key thing really is that the Indian pharmaceuticals industry developed very strongly in a domestic way in the from the 1970s onwards, when a new patent law was enacted basically under the government of Indira Gandhi. And what happened in this patent law is that companies were freed from patents that drug companies held in the U.S. or in Europe, and they were free to produce their own generic versions of it. So it was a transition from a product patent regime to a process patent regime. And over the years, you had this enormous development of an Indian generic industry where the thresholds to market entry are very, very low. So you're looking at a situation where until recently, apparently, no one even knew how many pharmaceutical companies were even operating in India. You know, you had estimates up to maybe it's 5,000, maybe it's 10,000. We don't even know how many pharmaceutical producers are out there because the thresholds of entry were so low. And of course, you still have now also some very large companies, and they would be also multinationally present. But a lot of companies are also just producing for the Indian market, and many pharmaceutical companies also just produce for even a regional market, right? And again, sort of what's so striking about India is that all of the drugs that are available in the U.S., for example, in the psychopharmaceuticals market, they have been available generically in India for many years. There has been a change, of course, to the drug regime, which came through the World Trade Organization rules. So India had to become compliant to WTA rules. There was a sort of transition period from 1995 until 2005. And since then, the Indian manufacturers can't sort of use any molecule and produce their own generic versions anymore. But up to that point, as you know, all of the major psychopharmaceuticals that are still in use, down to the latest atypical antipsychotics, for example, they have been produced already in a generic version, and that means they're very cheap generally, and they're very widely available. So you have even studies done on, not just how many hundreds or even thousands of versions of these drugs are being produced, but also are they actually on sale anywhere, and do people buy them, and are they able to buy them? And it turns out, yes, they are extremely widely available. You go into rural pharmacies in India, and they will have at least one version of fluoxetine and one version of sertraline and all the other major antidepressants, antipsychotics that are out there. And that also indicates, of course, that these drugs are far more widely used than is generally acknowledged, definitely also what is being acknowledged by the World Health Organization. So that's roughly the situation. And another side of the coin is that the pharmaceutical marketing practices are almost unregulated. So things down to the level of offering money to doctors to get them to switch to a particular company's brand, for example, or saying, oh, doctor, do you perhaps need a new car, or would you like to go on a holiday in Vienna with your family? Things like that are absolutely entrenched in India, and there's a level of influence that pharmaceutical companies take on prescribing doctors that is, I think, even unparalleled to what you would find in the U.S. and in Europe. And of course, that will have an impact also on the prescription habits of doctors, and probably on the whole, these are not this is not a good influence. And from my own research on, you know, prescription practices, particularly also with general physicians in India. So it's not, I've not just been looking at the specialized psychiatrists, but also at who else is actually using all of these drugs. And of course, you also find that the general physicians are major prescribers, routine prescribers of psychopharmaceuticals nowadays, and even untrained, unlicensed rural quack doctors would be prescribing these drugs. And often the only source of information that these doctors would have about what these drugs are and what the possible side effects of these might be comes from the pharmaceutical companies themselves. So you can see that there's definitely a huge impact there. But again, sort of coming full circle to where we started, basically the multinational drug companies that originated many of these drugs, such as Eli Lilly or Pfizer or other drug companies, they actually have to play by the same rules that are established in India. And in so many ways, the rules are established by the Indian generic manufacturers, I would argue.
Wow, it's the what we talk about in the U.S. is the wild, wild west. A couple of questions for you to answer in any length or way you wish. Two or three have entered my mind already. And by the way, I'm just very, very grateful for this information. This is new to me. I imagine it's new to almost everybody in the listening audience. First, are there prescription do all the drugs require prescriptions in India? I know in Great Britain, even, you can get some drugs non-prescription that we require prescriptions for. So assuming that the law is even being followed, what about the prescription laws in India?
Yeah, when you look at the packets that these drugs are coming in, they all have some kind of print on it saying that these drugs are only to be used with a prescription from a licensed doctor. But in actual practice, you really can get almost all of the available psychopharmaceutical drugs without a prescription. And that is also a very, very important feature of what is happening in India, so that a patient might get the very first prescription of a drug, possibly even by a quack doctor who has no training whatsoever and whose signature on the prescription would technically not count for this being a legal prescription at all, but it doesn't really matter. No one's checking for that. Or probably those rural quack doctors might be dispensing those drugs themselves, you know, sitting that they're not just prescribing but also acting as a kind of rural pharmacy. But even if you do get a prescription from a licensed prescriber, but also even if it's a very highly trained and even if you end up with a very, very good psychiatrist, for example, you could just take this prescription and never return to this doctor, but just keep the prescription and get it filled again and again and again. And no pharmacist will question you on that. And that actually has an impact also on the way that the doctors are using those drugs, because from my interviews with them and from, you know, observing the practices, I know that they very often also take a guess on whether a patient that they see will even return to them for a checkup, for seeing whether the prescription needs to be changed. And sometimes they would sort of say, I couldn't give this patient this drug because my feeling was that probably because of poverty and because of them having to travel very far, they might never even return to me. And they all had cases of patients who would receive a prescription and with sort of saying, please return to me in maybe 4 weeks and we'll take it from there. And then those patients never turn up again. And then maybe 5 years down the line, they would return. And the doctors would, of course, always be shocked to learn that the patient might have been using a drug that had been prescribed once, you know, continuously for 5 years, and of course had no problems getting refills at any pharmacy, but with all of the possible side effects that this would entail. So, you know, that's the long answer to your question, is that no, there really is hardly any effective, one would have to say, an effective regulation of, you know, the dispensing of prescriptions.
Wow. Remind us how many people are in India. It's like the second largest nation?
It's that's right, yeah. And it's 1.2 billion people living in India.
And now we all know that there's a huge poverty class in India. From what you're saying, they're being penetrated by these drug companies through all of these docs who may or may not be charlatans. Is that the case, that the poor are in fact being caught up in this?
I think so, yeah. And to a much larger extent probably than is being recognized even, because again, when the World Health Organization thinks about the treatment gap, for example, and says that low and middle income countries such as India have a huge treatment gap that needs to be closed urgently. What the WHO never really takes into account is in their calculations. They're just looking at fully trained personnel in government institutions. But these people really are just a fraction of the actual prescribers or people who are dispensing psychopharmaceuticals in India. You know, there's no way of telling for sure, but I would, my feeling is that it's probably less than 5% of all of the drugs that are being prescribed are actually handled by these people who are by those kind of prescribers who are being captured by the World Health Organization statistics, and the other 95% are people out there in the private market, many of them licensed, many of them unlicensed, and none of that actually ever comes into the knowledge, really, of what is happening. So that's why you have this picture of kind of chronic under-treatment, chronic under-prescription of these drugs, when actually when you do sort of ground-up ethnographic work, you find that a lot of people are on psychopharmaceuticals who might not even know that they're on psychopharmaceuticals, but some doctor has given these drugs to them. So you actually have a situation of over-prescription, I would argue, in many areas, and often that the patients have only a very faint view of what is happening. And it's happening also because it's part of being a good doctor to prescribe a lot of drugs all at once. So you never walk out of a doctor's consultation and only have one drug, but you usually have five or six or seven drugs on your prescription. And very often it can happen to you that one of those drugs is, for example, an SSRI antidepressant. And again, based on the ethnography of what is happening and what the doctors tell me, is that, for example, they would say a patient comes in and he's 65 years or older, the children are living abroad, and the patient is complaining about some chronic pain and some problems with sleep. So I routinely prescribe antidepressant, maybe, you know, throw in an SSRI because allegedly they have no side effects whatsoever, and you can just give these drugs to anyone there's no harm attached to them whatsoever, and probably what they are talking about when they talk about their pain or their problems with sleep is ultimately some kind of depression, for example. And then they would also argue that there's no point in telling the patients about the diagnosis of depression, so they would avoid calling it depression, and they would also totally avoid calling the drugs antidepressants, because that would just stir up unnecessary resistance in the patients, who would feel like, oh, I'm not a mental patient, please, I've come to you for pain, and now you're giving me this mad person's drugs. So they would avoid all mention of that.
Well, folks, I mean, as bad as this sounds, it has a lot of parallels in the U.S. In my legal work, I'm constantly coming across physicians who basically give out these same drugs as candy in the U.S. and don't give any of the very definitely required warnings here in the U.S. and masquerade antipsychotic drugs as antidepressants and who, just don't give out adequate information. Obviously, much, much worse in India, but it's same parallel. Human nature and human social structures have a lot in common around the world, unfortunately. Two things in mind. I'm really just hearing so much new things today that it, like, have all these questions, they come and go through my mind. but one thing I want to point out to folks is that while we focus on psychiatry here, one of the disasters that this creates is the flooding of the society with antibiotics, then antibiotic resistance. So as hard as we may try in this country or in Great Britain to Canada to be rational in the prescription of antibiotics so as not to create entirely drug-resistant microbes, they're just going to keep coming out of places like India and Vietnam. And I know a very good man who works in the area of psychiatric reform who got a treatment-resistant drug that caused pneumonia when he was in Vietnam. I mean, he survived, but it was a really difficult situation. My question, I don't think I've asked, is about children. To what extent do you think children are getting inundated with these psychiatric drugs and all the other drugs?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Based on my own research, I'd say that the medication levels of children are probably still substantially lower than in the U.S., for example, mm-hmm. so that there's still a greater resistance to actually using them. And I've also not seen probably as many children being treated, for example, for ADHD as is probably happening in the U.S. And that's actually really interesting and something that would be worth dissecting on several levels, you know, because on the one hand, many psychiatrists also work very hard to destigmatize psychiatric practice, but also the uses of psychopharmaceuticals. So you would have clinics that don't even call themselves that they are psychiatry clinics, but they would call themselves, you know, an institute for the mind or something like that. And they would advertise their services also as intellectual IQ testing or, help your child excel in school and in academic life so as to, you know, you go to these places and someone, one of your neighbors, for example, sees you and doesn't point a finger at you and say, oh, you're taking your child to a madman's doctor. But maybe your child just did some IQ testing and, to get even better in school. So they're working hard in that way. But still, it's, in my view, almost surprising, actually, when you look at the rampant use of psychopharmaceuticals for the adult population, that just based on my own insights, children aren't as medicated or over-medicated as they seem to be in the U.S. But that probably also has to do with, you know, how strong the academic pressure is, or how the it works in terms of who is actually referring them. So I think that one factor probably is that teachers don't play quite as active a role in referring pupils that they find difficult to deal with in class right away to the psychiatrist, which is the case for U.S. And European schools, where the teachers are often sort of the gatekeepers towards the psychiatric services.
Yeah, and something I've seen in the U.S. that may also account for this is the extended family, and where parents aren't both working, where families aren't isolated like they often are in America, where there's more extended families, there's more of a sense of we're responsible for our children. We're raising them. Little Jimmy or Janie has a problem. Well, Auntie will come over and help out, or Grandma will help out. And I saw this also in the early years of my work in the African-American community in the U.S., even though many of the families were lacking in a male in the household. They were often extended families with mothers and grandmothers. And often they had very protective attitudes toward their children in terms of not wanting to expose them to psychiatric drugs. So maybe the presence of a more extended family system in India is one of the things that sort of gives them a more of a direct hands-on relationship to their children, so that maybe a better spiritual connection, maybe, and so they're less likely to turn to an outside force to intervene. Does that make any sense?
That does make sense, yes. And of course, there's still a lot of research also going on these factors that might protect people, for example, in India, against mental illness better than they do in the U.S., and definitely stronger family ties and much more socializing and this extended family support network are, you know, routinely found to be probably of major importance in that way. So that, you know, there are, of course, these famous studies also on recovery from schizophrenia, and those findings arguing that your chances of recovery are much better if you're in India than you are in the U.S., and that probably being attributable to those stronger social ties and stronger families. And one thing I also found from working with psychiatrists is that they would argue, and I recently wrote an article also on this, basically them saying, you know, we are so surprised that we're not seeing many, many more children than we actually do at the moment. So that so many factors of social change that are happening in India at the moment, and definitely in the last 10, 20 years, would make you expect a much higher percentage of children who are being seen by a psychiatrist. And one of them being this very strong development towards having just one child in the family anymore. So you used to have a lot of children in a family, and also in richer families. But now the situation is that, particularly in middle-class families in urban areas, you would tend to have only one child, and then invest everything you have in the success of that one child, and also saying you must have a good degree from your school in order to enter one of the universities, and then you become a doctor, preferably, or an engineer, or something that really pays a lot of money, but like we're putting all our investments and all our expectations on you. And if that one child basically has troubles and is not performing as well as the parents and the extended family probably would have hoped, then these problems should come out much more prominently again as well. And that would, the psychiatrists always expect, bring them to them much more than it actually happens. But again, that's also based on, you know, just the doctors being part of their own society and observing the changes, and even being parents themselves and seeing what is happening and the enormous pressures that children are under nowadays in India, and yet that they're not coming to the psychiatrist nearly as much as they should be. And maybe it does boil down to, among other things, to a much stronger sense of family.
We're talking, folks, with Stefan Ecks, ECKS, Director of Anthropology of Health and Illness Programs, and also a lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Edinburgh. Edinburgh, I guess it is, isn't it? Edinburgh.
Edinburgh, yeah. Edinburgh.
I'm so parochial. Although I have been there, folks. I've actually been there. I've been there. Originally, from what I understand, you're saying that that the drug companies in Southeast Asia and in India just broke international law, basically, and didn't pay any attention to patent laws and just flooded the country with cheap drugs. But then more recently, there have been accords that have brought them more into conformity with patent laws. Is that my understanding?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yeah.
Now, has that ended up in giving the big drug companies, you know, all of them, has that given them more power again in India? Does this mean that that the money is going to flow from Johnson into Johnson and Johnson and into Eli Lilly and all the other companies?
Well, if the psychopharmaceutical sector was operating in the same way as other health sectors were, then yes, that would be happening. But what's happening in the psychopharmaceuticals field is this withdrawal and curtailment of R&D investment by the companies as well. And, of course, even in the last few years, you've had an almost complete withdrawal of research funding from those companies. So that's one story also that I got really interested in, and something I'm working on at the moment is this crisis of psychopharmaceutical development, where people such as the former vice president of neuroscience at Eli Lilly asks why did it take so long for the industry to abandon psychiatry when it was clear that not a single mechanistically novel drug has reached the psychiatric market in more than 30 years. So if you have a situation like that where no new drugs have actually come out, those changes to the patent law have had no impact whatsoever on the ground. So the doctors have at their disposal all of the drugs that have been around until 2005 in very cheap, very easily available generic versions. And to my knowledge, there isn't really any drug available in India that, you know, is you know, significantly new and significantly more expensive simply because it hasn't come out anywhere in the U.S. or in Europe either. And that's why, again, the changes to the patent laws that have happened between 1995 and 2005 really had no impact whatsoever on psychiatry. Whereas in other fields, particularly when you think of infectious diseases or HIV/AIDS or cancer drugs, you know, the changes to the patent laws and the generic companies are not allowed anymore to just produce their own generic versions, that has had a huge impact, but not in psychiatry.
That's interesting. By the way, I meant to mention earlier the studies that Stefan X is talking, we're talking about earlier on schizophrenia, that the outcomes are better where there are extended families and worse where there are lots of drugs and people take them for longer periods of time and go to psychiatrists. That is where you and I live. Those are the WHO studies, the World Health Organization studies, and you can find them online if you just Google WHO. I'm looking at one right now. What did the WHO studies really find? So that's readily available, and I notice I don't have it up on my antipsychotic resource page. I don't have the WHO studies, I don't think. So I'll get them up there. There's so many of them. I'll get a couple of the more overarching ones. Well, this is all tremendously, interesting information. I occasionally read and cite the Indian Medical Journal and the Indian Journal of Psychiatry. I'm not sure of the exact names, but basically that's it. And I don't see a lot of great research coming out of there. I see a lot of clinical reports. Have you got any thoughts on the medical and psychiatric literature that's being produced in India and other less industrialized countries?
Well, the one thing that they all the psychiatrists I know complain about is that they have really no time for research, and it's not built into their daily practices nearly as much as it is in the U.S. So they just say, well, I'm practicing all day. I'm so busy. I have maybe 2 or 3 minutes per patient, and that fills my day from 8 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock at night, or even longer than that. And just the sheer number of research active psychiatrists, I think, is very, very small. And of course, the number of psychiatrists is very small in India. It's about, I don't know the latest figures, but it used to be sort of around 3,500 or 4,000 psychiatrists for a country of 1.2 billion, which then gives
that's
them...
That's like nothing.
That's
folks,
right.
We have so, I think the latest here is 40,000 in our country.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that gives some credence, again, of course, to World Health Organization claims about the treatment gap. You know, yeah. On that side, when the treatment gap is defined as... do people receive competent and, very specialized care, then I'd say, well, those claims are probably correct. But, of course, they receive a lot of other care. So, yeah, the psychiatrists are a very small group, and they're not very research active. And the few who are out there, also, again, when research is done, at all, it tends to be funded by pharmaceutical companies who are just looking for some kind of, validation of certain treatments being that are out there already, that they also work with a particular group of patients in India. But, by and large, it's just not research focused. And the doctors would be the first to admit that and say they wish they had much more time for research, but they don't.
Is medicine socialized in India? I just know almost nothing about this.
No, it's completely the opposite in practice. So you do have a government health system, but it's one of the most underfunded and impoverished in the world, definitely also in comparison to GDP and by any measure. And what's been happening is that the government health system has been even deteriorating from an already very low level to the point that most people, including poor people, would tend to go to private practitioners. And that's where they then have to pay out of pocket. And so although there is a government health system it's out there, but really in practice you find that out-of-pocket health expenditures is a major reason for people to fall into debt, and often also catastrophic debt. So you've got a slightly more serious health problem in the family, or even something like cancer, and the treatments would cost 10 or 100 times what a household would even earn in a year. So these are can be extremely difficult, and to that extent the most of the money that flows comes from the patients themselves, and that also influences where they go, because they only go to doctors that they feel are actually giving them some kind of bang for the buck, basically. And they would choose their doctors themselves, and you can also contact a specialist right away. So there's hardly any referral system from a GP upwards, for example. Like in the UK, it's where I'm living in Scotland in particular, it is a fully socialized system, and the first doctor and usually the last doctor that I ever see would be a GP, because I wouldn't be able even to contact any specialist doctor unless my GP refers me, and he usually refers you only when there's a very, good reason to do so. Whereas in India, people often walk straight up to the specialist doctor, having self-diagnosed themselves, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why neurologists are doing so well in India, because people don't necessarily want to go to a psychiatrist, and then they still think, well, maybe there is something wrong with my brain, so the person, or with my nerves, so maybe the person that I should actually contact is a neurologist as a nerve specialist, and then they would contact those doctors first and be reluctant to even go to a psychiatrist.
By the way, folks, I really do want to comment that probably societies are best served by being on the low end of psychiatric services. So I want to just, lay that out, that this is no ordinary discussion from my viewpoint of the poor underserved folks in India in regard to psychiatry. Once, for example, the field of children starts to get cultivated by the industries and doctors, this is going to be a disaster for the children, given especially that they may just get one prescription for Ritalin or an antipsychotic drug and stay on it for 10 years from the story we're hearing today. So let's especially keep those children underserved by psychiatry throughout the world, and let's keep warning adults about what terrible risks that we actually have in terms of the psychiatric drugs. And again, we're talking to Stephen X. I didn't ever get to talk to Stephen much on the phone because my phone service wasn't working to Europe today. So we didn't get to do a pre-interview. And I'm just so glad that you're here. Is there anything more personal about yourself in about 2 minutes? How you've gotten involved in this area? What, anything more about your background? And we could even close the show with that if you just tell us a little bit more, because you've been such a good scientific reporter today. It'd be nice to hear a little bit about more who you are.
Yeah, that's a good question also. How did I get into this? Because actually there's still until today hardly any research on the uses of psychopharmaceuticals in India, in South Asia, in East Asia more extendedly. So it's a very rare, weird orchid kind of field of study. And I often wondered, why am I the only person out there actually interested in this, seemingly, even after, you know, quite a few years of working on this. And I still wonder, actually. So the way I got into this, as far as I remember, I was really interested in the question of suicide and suicidality. Again, that's a field that fascinated me because you had these early studies by Durkheim, for example, as a social scientist on suicide. And then right. It seemed like, you know, somehow anthropology with this particular view of ethnographic field research where you live in a particular place for a long time and you work primarily through, you know, firsthand observations and by conversations with people who you know for quite a while, that anthropology apparently had very, very little, if anything, to say on suicides and suicidality, and that fascinated me. And back then, there hasn't been much research on suicides, but there has actually been a huge wave of excellent research that's come out just in the last 5 years or so by a number of colleagues. And but not
suicide
by me, because
in cultures other than Great Britain and the U.S. and so on.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So on suicide,
well, good, good.
In India.
Stefan, we're going to have to end in a minute. I had one question I forgot to ask you, which is, did my work fit anywhere in your development?
Absolutely.
I suspect not.
No, absolutely. I mean, this actually paved the way, and it was incredibly important for me to have work like yours, critiques of psychiatry from within psychiatry, basically. Because even when I started doing this work in India, it was almost like you cannot possibly work on the uses of psychopharmaceuticals, because you really need to, this is all completely clear and there's a very strong psychiatric consensus on this, so there's no point in having any kind of non-psychiatric perspective on this. So
oh
that
boy.
Was something
yeah.
that was being told to me. And also, you know, over the course of the years that I've been working on this, it went from, oh, these drugs are marvelous,
yeah.
and, you know, poor people everywhere in the world should receive
yeah.
them.
We got to,
actually,
Stephen,
we
have to
strong
wrap
doubts
up
about
now.
Them.
The music is going to start and overwhelm us in a minute. But thank you so much for being on and sharing your knowledge. And as you keep growing and developing stuff, I'd like to hear you come back. I think folks just need to hear about what's going on in the rest of the world. And I think you're the only one I've ever heard talk in this detail about this subject. Thanks very, very much for being on. A quick question. Did you read Toxic Psychiatry early on? Because that's what I so often hear.
Yeah, I did. I did. And also other works, you know, by David Healy, for example. And
yeah.
as they emerged. And again, it's been incredibly important to have that critique of psychopharmaceuticals
yeah.
for my own work.
Thank you so much. Stefan X, ECKS, thank you so much for being on the Dr. Peter Bregenauer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter.